Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. And today on Hercules and the Space Gods, I am proud to bring you Nick Curto Presents the Urantia Book. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you?
Thank you very much, Hercules. Really well. We had a beautiful day here in Manhattan, beautiful fall day. I spent some of it in Central Park, and the trees are gorgeous, and it was brisk, but really a perfect fall day. So I'm a very happy camper right now.
That sounds like a lovely way to have spent Sunday. Your guest is here, and I'm really looking forward to your show.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much, Hercules. You are the best producer anyone could possibly want, and I really do mean that, as you know. And so here we go. This is welcome to everybody. This is Nick Curto Presents the Urantia Book, which is a live 60-minute podcast, and I'm Nick Curto, your host. The Urantia Book has truly been an expansive, breathtaking experience for me to explore this inspiring, eye-opening, mind-expanding, and truly loving masterwork, which is called the Fifth Epical Revelation. The text introduces the word Urantia. Now, that's spelled U-R-A-N-T-I-A, and that name is given to our planet Earth. So the Urantia Book is translated to the Earth Book, meant for us here now. And it states the intent to present enlarged concepts and advanced truth. The book unites religion, science, philosophy, and history, and has an enormous amount of material about science. And that is unique to this kind of literature, and it's presented by celestial beings. That's who are the authors of this book. That's a whole other story we will get into at some other program. It's quite an amazing story. Among the topics the Urantia Book discusses is the origin and meaning of life, mankind's place in the universe, the relationship between God and people, not only of this planet but others, and the entire life of Jesus, with a huge amount of information that the Bible or any other works have never, ever touched or addressed. That was one of the eye-openers to me when I first went through this book. I'm a lifelong member of the Urantia Society of Greater New York, and that's made up of Urantia Book readers from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I've been their past president, outreach chair, among other positions through the years. I'm currently on the outreach committee, and that is run by Barry Clark, who is an amazing man, very unique to our movement, and a technical genius. He's responsible for the beautiful websites of the Urantia Book, which I'm going to tell you about briefly. So if you want to get a pencil and a piece of paper, the Urantia Book has been translated into 28 world languages, which is an amazing feat. And since it's 2,000 pages long, it's sold at better bookstores worldwide. And you can now both read it and listen to it on the Internet. Now, that's quite an achievement. And the book is listed on two websites, and I'm going to give you both of them. They're both excellent, beautifully designed, and easy to navigate. So here we go. The first one is www.urantiabook.org. Again, urantiabook.org. Now, the other one is www.urantia.nyc. Again, both of those are amazingly good websites, and they give you a good picture of what the Urantia Book is all about. Okay, let's get right to it. Tonight, my featured guest on the program is a longtime reader of the Urantia Book and an active member of the Urantia Book family. A very warm welcome to you, Linda Huff.
Thank you, Nick. It's very good to be here with you tonight.
I've been really looking forward to our interview with you tonight. And I want to just start off with asking you, first of all, where do you now live? What's your location currently?
I live in Bloomfield, Connecticut, which is the next town north of Hartford.
Okay. And I'm originally from Springfield, Massachusetts. That's where I was born and raised. So I'm a kind of a New Englander. I moved to Manhattan many moons ago, but I still have family there, too, in New England and Massachusetts. I want to ask you some questions. First of all, where were you originally born and raised?
So I'm from Maine, and as we talk along, you will be able to hear my accent. It's never really disappeared. I grew up in a small town called Hollis, which is about 40 minutes west of Portland. And oh. I was raised there by my parents, and I have three sisters and a brother. And I went to school at University of Maine in Farmington. And my first couple of positions were also in Maine.
Now, were your parents spiritual, religious at all?
So my parents were, but in very, very different ways. And I don't think I really appreciated what a complimentary perspective they gave me. So my mother was very involved in the traditional Protestant church. We all went to, there were two churches merged at the time, American Baptist and Congregational United Church of Christ in Buxton, Maine. And she started us all in Sunday school at age three. And we
wow.
went to Sunday school, we went to youth group, we went to church. She was on the taught Sunday school. She was in the Christian education program. And she understood how the church worked. She was not the one, though, who got my curiosity going. Now, my father would go occasionally, and he certainly had been raised in the Baptist church by his mother. But he's the one who taught me to think more spiritually. He would be the one to pose questions like, you know, there's a difference between Mother Nature and God. And what he was trying to say to me is that we can't blame God for the problems that happen that are just involved in the natural world. And so I had a kind of an experiential experience with my father, lots of humor and joy. And yet my mother was the one who was faithfully getting us all up and dressed and out the door and going to worship. And I really have never completely ever drifted away from the church. There have been a few places that I have paused from a few weeks here and there, but I still do attend the traditional church as well.
Right. So you have pretty fertile ground right from the very beginning that did influence your life, and as you grew up, certainly did also. A lot of people from various faiths, as you know, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, and many, many other faiths also embrace the Urantia Book. And I think that's really quite wonderful and remarkable that the Urantia Book really blends into other faiths quite well. And a lot of people have told me that, too. And surprisingly, I've met people who, for most of their life, were atheists, which is quite a decision to make, that you really want to say you don't want to be involved in spirituality at all. And then somehow the Urantia Book came into their life, and now they consider themselves Urantia Book readers, believers. And I think that really speaks quite well of the Urantia Book and its scope. I also want to just go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My experience is that the Urantia community and movement, which is made up of quite a few different groups, is probably the most diverse and interesting group of people I've ever been with. And I have been fortunate enough to do some traveling to attend some of the international conferences. And one thing I think they all have in common, though, at some point in their lives, they became seekers. They wanted to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what kept them looking, or what had the Urantia book find them. So I, too, find it a most powerful group of people, and appreciate that we've had people of Jewish faith. And I knew one person from, several from Jehovah's Witness. It's really a very diverse community, and I'm grateful for that.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I've met some of the most amazing, wonderful, interesting people in the Urantia movement. Occasionally, when I've gone to other places traveling, I look to see in the places I were if there was a Urantia study group. And in many cases, there were. And I got in touch with them and found out when they were going to study the book, what night or afternoon. And they said, Nick, you'd be more than welcome to join us. And I did. And I found that to be a wonderful experience. If you're traveling, if you see that there is a study group in that area, see if you can join them. Now, I'll tell you, I wouldn't trade that for anything. I want to do more of that when traveling becomes a little more, shall we say, easy than it is now. But I've had some wonderful experiences that way in various parts of the world. So, again, the Urantia family, as you just said, is very diverse, exciting people, and from all walks of life, absolutely. I want
right.
to ask you – go ahead.
There are study groups that are online, too, if people want to have that opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely true. I want to ask you also just briefly, but I would like to ask you about your different work assignments through the years, like what kinds of occupation jobs you've had up until now.
Yes, that is a very important part of the story of actually how I found the Urantia book, or how it found me. So because I do have a foundation within the church, after I finished college, I spent a couple of years trying to decide what was the most important thing to me. And I felt that I was hearing the call of God to become a minister. And so I did decide to go to seminary, which is a 3.5-year program. And I went to Andover Newton, which at that time was outside of Boston in Newton Center. And I did complete the program and became ordained in 1985. My first assignment was two very tiny, small little churches that were 9 miles apart from each other. And I drove back and forth every week, and I preached every week. And I was in that place for 9 years. Lots of things happened, and, you know, age 28 to 37 are very formative years in a person's life when you're trying to understand what you really believe as compared to what you've been taught and what questions come up for you. And so I was comfortable in the church and comfortable with what I was taught, I always felt like there were too many missing answers to questions. I always wanted to know more about what was going on, and I was never content with answers like it's just a mystery. I really want to know what happened at the resurrection.
Absolutely.
I was very fortunate with some of the people who came into my life, including the pastor who was at the church of my youth during high school years, and then again another a woman pastor, actually, who was available during those 2 years in between college and seminary, who encouraged me to think about going to seminary. These two people were very important to me. And seminary was a positive experience. I have one good friend I've kept in touch with, and there was lots of opportunities to read and get involved in pastoral care and ethics and subjects that I enjoyed. I went to a very progressive seminary, very much involved in concerns for the world and society, concerns for poverty, concerns for racial justice, people who were marginalized and living on the end. And I was very much encouraged to put my faith into action, what we would call social justice ministry. When I got to these two small little country churches, and the smallest one had a year-round population of 900 people, so it was tiny, I realized that that particular social justice ministry didn't wear very well for the long haul. You know, they were doing the best they could. They had their lives. They were trying to raise their families. Many of them were retired. They were not going to be marching in the streets. They were not going to necessarily be starting new advocacy programs. The people in that town of West Newfield, Maine, were all pretty much of the same background. So I began to look and think, what exactly is my responsibility? What should I be preaching about on a weekly basis? I, too, was finding my own sermons to be kind of boring. So that started a good 2 or 3 year search. So I was open and looking in new age places, I would call it, metaphysical places. I explored the idea of reincarnation for a while. And I was just a seeker, trying to absorb and take as much in as I could. Do you want me to tell how I found the book?
That was actually, Linda, going to be my very next question. So please go ahead. Yes.
So I was at these two small churches, and I said, I need a break. I need to be able to have an opportunity to go away for a few days and get recharged. So I had the opportunity to take an R&R, like a reading planning time, and had an opportunity to go to some place close by that was very inexpensive and just kind of fortunate all the way around. And I said, well, if I'm going to do this legitimately, I better take some things to read with me, because otherwise I have to report back when I come back to the people and the churches. So I went to my desk. I took a couple of the things you would expect. And then I looked over on the desk to this pile. And I said, you know, there's this magazine sitting here, and it's been sitting here for, oh, 6, 7, 8 months. Maybe it's time I should look at it. And I remember when this magazine came into the mail, because I looked at it very quickly, and I said, I don't know what this is. It doesn't look like any of my traditional junk mail. It's not related to the traditional church. It's not related to any of the metaphysical groups I looked at. So I just put it in this pile. So into my bag it went. I went on my R&R break, and I did pick up the magazine, and I did started to read it. It was a magazine by Meredith Sprunger, who I later learned was also within my same denomination, Congregational United Church of Christ, but he had become a teacher of religion at college. And he made a vow to himself, he was a long-term reader of the Rancher book, that when he retired, he would send his magazine of a few pages, and he would take the yearbook of the Methodist and the United Church of Christ clergy, and he would start to send free issues to everybody beginning with the letter A. And at some point, he began to get to the letter H, and I got one of his three magazines. And as I read the magazine, I was very, very intrigued. He actually didn't have a lot of very specific quotes about the book itself. I mean, I kept saying, I want to know what it says. I want to know what it says. He had more testimonials of how the book had changed people's lives and why it was important to him. And so anyway, when I got back from my R&R, I went about the process of finding and buying a book. And it was one of our more difficult times as a movement. So I did have a bookstore order it for me. And it is one of the original publications. You know, the book comes in different formats, you know, hard copy, soft copy, one column, two columns. But I do have the original format, and that's the one that is in front of me that I will share a couple passages from later.
Fantastic, really. And, of course, Meredith Sprunger, what a wonderful man. I had the opportunity to meet him. I believe I was in Colorado at one of those major gatherings of the Urantia Book readers from all over.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Meredith, and I immediately liked him so much. What a loving, giving person he was and still is. And I cherish the fact that I had met him and spoken to him. So, wow, you really... just because of the way life works, you got such an amazing start with what you just said about how you found, yeah.
And when I got the book, I didn't know of anybody else who read it. I didn't know of anybody else in Maine or anyways. I was in Maine at that point. And so I had lots of questions. And so I wrote a letter to Meredith and said, is there anybody around I can talk to about this book? And he gave me the name and contact information for Helena Sprague. So I was in Maine, in Connecticut. And we did talk on the phone a number of times. And then I did get to meet her at her New Hampshire summer home and eventually went to one of those also very big conferences in Hyacinth, Canada, and got to meet Meredith. So it was a number of months, but these are two very important people in the movement. And Helena Sprague was actually one of the reasons I decided to relocate and come to Connecticut.
That's truly wonderful. You were in such amazing hands right from the very, very beginning. I'm really very happy that your life took that course. And of course, the Urantia book, as you know, is quite a big book. It's 2,000 pages big. And when I first saw the book, I thought, is this a law book? It was, you know, just a very plain blue cover. And it was so big. And I thought, oh, my God, could someone ever really read this entire book? And I first learned of the book when I was in a Unitarian church I was attending for 2 years, and the minister said, for our last reading, we're going to read from the Urantia book. And I thought, what an interesting name, never heard it before. And I thought maybe it was Eastern Indian, it just had Urantia sound to it. And then he read a couple of paragraphs, and then we broke, and everybody went back home. And I stayed there in about 20 minutes, because I literally was like a deer in the headlights that I, after he read those passages, I needed time to just relax, calm down, and just stay there collect myself, because I was so impressed with what I heard. It was like nothing I've ever heard before, and it totally enveloped me and made me want to know, what in the world is this book? So that's how I got a hold of it. And, you know, when I ask that question to people I interview on this program, how did you discover the Urantia book, or how did the Urantia book discover you? I get incredible answers every single time, really. Everybody's got a different story, and they're all quite wonderful. Now, when you got a hold of this book and started really looking through it, 2,000 pages, did you go from beginning at the very beginning, or did you go from look at the table of contents and pick things and see what did they say about this? How did you approach it?
Well, it is a very large book, and it has incredible depth. And this may seem impossible to people who've never seen the book, but when I first got my copy, I opened it up and I said, this is a very, very detailed table of contents. And believe it or not, I spent the first 3 hours reading the table of contents because I wanted to know what was the beginning of the story and what was the end of the story and how things were divided up. And, of course, I did have my theological education in the back of my mind, and I wanted to see if it was similar or different or compatible. And there are four sections of the book, but the last four is all about the life and teachings of Jesus. And I could see some things that made me really, really curious, and some of the things I've actually been asking about, well, what about Jesus' family? What happened to his father? How come we don't hear about him? What about the last 18 years between the time he was baptized and the time that he started his public ministry? So that's how I got started. But I have to confess that some of the other parts of the book, which are much more difficult to comprehend, and some of the science and the cosmology, took me much, much longer. So it actually took me 7 years before I could say that I've read every single paper, every single chapter in the book. But it was important for me at one point to say I need to go into those more difficult chapters and read everything so I really fully understand the whole grasp of the book. And it's really a very, very important to me in my life.
Well, I can say that I pretty much did that same thing that you did. And as you know, how interesting it is that there's four parts of the book, and the first part of the book is probably the most difficult. It's not easy reading, and you'd think that, I'm just guessing here, that would be the easiest part and that they would slowly get you into the more complex issues and text. But actually, they start off full and terms that you've never, ever heard in your life before. And it takes a while to digest that. And then as you get into the second and third parts of the book, it starts relating. Things starting to make sense. Dots are connected. And you're going, okay, now I get it. Now I understand where they were going with this. And then the fourth part of the book, and I totally agree with what you just said. Of course, being raised Roman Catholic, the life story of Jesus, of course, is what you know and certainly love. And you have all the stories of the Bible and his life. But when you get to the Urantia book version of Jesus' life, it's not like reading about figures that in history. You are there. You are beside them. You are listening to what they're saying. You're understanding how they're thinking. Don't you agree with that? Like it's a much more detailed, enriched experience of what was going on in Jesus' life.
So we say in traditional circles of church that Jesus was human and divine, but most of us have no way to talk about that. And we probably err on the side of his divinity. But the Urantia book really taught me about Jesus the person, as well as Jesus who was divine and God. And my most memorable Lent, I was the first year that I was really reading right along in the Jesus papers, I was actually reading about his death and about the crucifixion, and at the same time that we were in Lent, and I have to say, I'm still preaching in the traditional church at this point, and it was the most wonderful, unbelievable Lent, Holy Week, Easter experience I've ever had, even since, that 1992 when I was looking at the book, because there was just so many details about, why did he have to die, and was the death have to happen that way, and the whole story about the atonement, which is pretty complicated, is one of the reasons that I decided that I believed in the book. I think most people start out skeptical and you're reading along and you think, does this make any sense? And I was there. You know, I definitely had a lot of questions. That and the personalities of the 12 disciples, those are the two things that really convinced me that the book was real and authentic.
I've had experience where other people have said something very similar to what you just said. And it, to me, it's almost like the fourth part of the book is almost a time machine, because you literally are transported to the various episodes of Jesus' life. You really get to know deeply the people, his family, his disciples, mm-hmm. the people he met along the way in his journey of life. And it's like being there. It's like being beside them, listening to them, and seeing what they were, you know, they're real people here, and what they were asking, and what the reply that Jesus had for them. And it is really, I know that in study groups, when they get to the fourth part of the Rancho book and they're reading the life of Jesus, a lot of times people tear up because it's so beautifully written and so affecting that it's so beautiful on so many sections that it's quite emotional. And I've seen men and women often, during even when they're reading, it's their turn to read out loud for the group, and they have to stop and wipe a tear because it's so affecting and so beautifully written. And you really feel as though you are there. And that is a huge, huge accomplishment that this book does do. I really, it's a thrilling part of that. It's my favorite part. I'll tell you, it is my favorite part of the entire Rancho book is the fourth part. The other parts, of course, are striking. They are eye-opening and certainly expanding your knowledge on so many levels. It's very thrilling, but the fourth part of that book is absolutely amazing. Were there any particular issues that you, when you started reading the book, that you were kind of hoping that the book would address? And then if you found that it did address it, what were your feelings on that? I'd just be curious if there were any particular issues.
Well, there were issues in both directions. So I grew up in a Protestant church. Think about white New England congregational churches with white steeples, plain white glass. This is very different from probably your Roman Catholic background. We didn't believe really about angels, or we didn't have a lot of stained glass pictures. We were into the intellect, the thinking, the rational, the, understanding our actions and how we applied ourselves as moral people. So not only have great detail about our celestial friends and our celestial beings, but also to see how much they influenced the book, its origins, and how many different types they were. There was so much detail about numbers, how many numbers in this group, how many numbers in that group, that at first that was hard for me to swallow. But I understood after a while a couple of things, that the book was describing an orderly, natural creation that a God of intelligence, of course, would want, a creative world that makes sense. And if you look at a snowflake or if you look at a butterfly, there is a real beauty in the way that the elements come together. No two snowflakes could ever be the same. So I began, even though I didn't memorize or understand all those details initially, I began to see, of course, this is the kind of world that the God would make, who was intelligent and caring. It would have design and structure and order. And I came to begin to take comfort by that.
That makes total sense.
Doesn't make
go,
sense.
Go ahead, please.
I would have to explain to people who might not know the fullness and the richness of the cosmology, because we do believe that the celestial beings were given permission and directives to have this book given to human nature, because we have so many problems in our world and that we needed extra help. So this book is understood as a revelation with guidelines to help us. I also struggled with things around the Trinity. I'm preaching and teaching, and there are many, many new words here. And so I had to learn in my own way how to translate the language of the book and the language of the church and yet keep the concepts the same and consistent and explain the meaning of what I thought I was gaining in language that would be appropriate for the pulpit. And I early on made the decision, unlike your Unitarian pastor, that I was not going to put the Evangel book out there, because that was not under the contract by which I was called. But what people didn't know, and I felt very comfortable, was that as I was preparing all my sermons, and say it's about the Sermon on the Mount or about the disciples being sent out two by two, or the miracle of the water being turned into wine, I always went and read those same passages in the Evangel book. It became a commentary for me, and that's actually how I became so well knowledgeable about the stories in part four. And then I would say, okay, so what is the meat? What is the substance? What is the piece that's missing from everyday understanding, whether it's about a miracle or prayer? And I would try to reframe it, which Jesus was great. Jesus was a great storyteller, and he reframed everything. He took what he wanted from the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, and he heightened it. And I tried to do the same thing. And people would always say, your sermons are so interesting. I never thought about it that way. And yet I purposely tried to stay within the common language of the people, of what they already knew. Does that make sense?
I think that's exactly the right way to go. You certainly did that. The Evangel book is the most totally loving book you could ever hope to find. When some people say, I am a God-fearing person, God-fearing, and I'm thinking, mm-hmm. I don't really like hearing the word fearing God, because the Evangel
right.
book is saying he is totally love itself. That the Rancher book is filled with love and understanding, and that's how God is portrayed. And that made more sense to me than thinking I have to fear him. I have to fear that. Again, that made total sense, and I gravitated towards the teaching of the Rancher book because on just that alone, that was one of the big things that in my life that changed. Like this, I am in really good company with this Rancher book. This is amazing, and so
yeah.
It propelled me to go through it. And every time I go, and I'm sure you would agree with this, every time you read the book, there are things that pop up that somehow you're thinking, you know what? I don't remember reading that before because it's so layered. Is that true with you?
Yes, that is true. And we all have our favorite sections. And then if you read in a group of people, which is a good idea because it gives you more depth, and people have different interests. So I did a group with some women friends last summer who wanted to understand the female deity of God. And it was very, very rich, because that's not something that, you know, I had spent a lot of time peeling the layers of the onion to get to the bottom. But there is a lot of positive images in the book. I use the word awesome to replace the fear of God. I think that when we encounter God, it may be fearful because we're unsettled, but it's like, oh, wow, it's an awesomeness is how I describe mm-hmm. that. So there's a lot of positive, loving images. There's a lot of balance between male and female that I miss in the traditional church. Yes, people do things wrong and evil is real, but there's not the same kind of punishing, sinning type of wrathful God that that has some churches have emphasized. So, it's been a fun adventure to try to make this story alive for lots of people.
One thing I was looking for in the book was information as to what happens when a person passes on. That is a very key question for many people, including me, and I'm sure for you too. And so I searched in the Urantia book for information about what how they presented that, what they said would happen to a person once they pass on from this planet, what happens next. And that is stirring. It is absolutely mind-blowing, incredibly wonderful. And it was more than I ever dreamed I would find anywhere. And it's on the pages of the Urantia book. Were there any particular things that stood out to you from the Urantia book when you were, say, looking for something, particular question that you found, anything that of note that you remember that perhaps surprised you?
Well, talk about the synchronicity of how God arranges you to have different people in your life. As I walked my way through my preaching career, which actually I just stopped preaching 2 years ago, so I have a long history of preaching and part-time churches, long-term churches, associates. But what I wound up doing is I was actually following in churches in which there had been a death of a clergy spouse, the death of a clergy. I was at some of the older churches that I had a lot of funerals. And so this whole question about life and death and what happens afterwards was something I was living. And I've had a couple experiences in my own personal life anyway that made me very interested in those things. And over again, I have just found those sections that talk about life after death as being a definite reality with a lot of good details. And we didn't finish the question about where am I ending my career. So for the last 13 years, I have been doing less formally in the church and more as a hospice bereavement coordinator. And between the Urantia teachings and working in hospice and being...
I wanted to talk about that because that is God's work of working in a hospice. And I would really just like to spend a little bit of time with that experience that you have had and are going through right now. Can you tell us, enlighten us about what a hospice is and what your work is about?
So hospice is a program that is to bring comfort and dignity to people with a terminal illness of 6 months or less. And hospice can be done in a person's home. It can be done in the nursing home. It can be done in assisted living. Wherever the person is sleeping becomes defined as home. There does have to be a 24-hour caregiver, though. And we come in with a team with nurses, social workers, chaplains, bereavement coordinators, home health aides. We have a medical director who's part of the team. And we try to take care of, help families take care of their loved ones without a lot of intrusiveness or invasion, but with pain medications and keeping them comfortable and letting them die their lives with dignity. So that's the general definition of hospice.
Right, and I've had an experience with a hospice situation with a few people that I love very much, and that they were going through that time in their life. And I don't have words for how much I admire the people who are in that kind of work. It's just so wonderful, so loving to be there for at such a critical time in a person's life, and to give them the love and the insight of the challenges that they're facing. And it's just such a lovely, wonderful work to be doing something in the hospice situation. I just want to tell you how much I admire you and others that do that kind of work. It's just so needed and so wonderful, and it's certainly God's work. It is.
Everything in my life has been directed by God, and I can see it with hindsight. But the people who've come into my life, the situations that I've been asked to serve in for ministry, the receiving of the Rancho book, there's a really divine plan here for me. And you need some kind of a universal thinking, I think, for hospice workers to feel comfortable and to stay with hospice for the long. It doesn't have to be a religious faith. I guess it could be a philosophy. But if you don't have something that says it's okay to let our loved ones go, it's okay to say, I love you, and we've all done the best we can, and maybe even to say, I'm going to see you again someday. Otherwise, it's just very, very difficult to be in people's lives in times of crisis. But I absolutely believe there's life after death. I can tell you stories from the Rancho book. I can tell you personal stories of my life. I can tell you hospice stories. And there seems to be, for some people, I don't have numbers, but for some people, they seem to be able to control in those last few hours when to leave the body after somebody that they've been waiting for comes out of state and they have a wonderful visit, they're gone. After someone has been hanging around the bed for days, visually watching, and they don't want anybody to see them, and that person goes to take a shower, they disappear and leave their body. It's the amount of amazing control and love is incredible. And the stories of patients who are calling out the name of their deceased loved ones, who I think many times they actually do see before they cross over.
I've had some experiences just like what you're saying. And Linda, I would like to next year, which is coming up very soon, but sometime at the beginning of next year, I'd like to devote one of the programs with you again and talk specifically about that section of your life and about the subject of hospice and all that entails. And I'm sure you have some wonderful stories firsthand. I just think that's a subject I'd be very interested in putting on as a full episode of podcast. So at some point, I hope that you can accept an invitation to really focus on that area, because I think it's so important. Now, I want to ask you right now, because my goodness, this is going quickly. This hour goes so fast, but could you share with us perhaps a passage or some lines from the Arantia book that especially resonate to you?
So I have in front of me a passage called The Phoenician Appearance. And in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we know that people see Jesus after he rose from the dead in a kind of a shadowy-like form. It's not really clear how many times. It's not really clear if they're repeat stories. All of that is spelled out with great clarity in the Arantia book. And this particular story begins on the 18th Melanchthon appearance. the 18th time after his resurrection that he appeared to a group of believers. And that in itself is interesting. But why I chose this particular section is it's about the fruits of the Spirit, which we have heard in many different ways. But I think that the Spirit of Truth and the various gifts of fruits of the Divine Spirit, which you'll hear, is the most beautiful, meaningful version I've ever encountered and gives great direction for application in our lives. So with that said, why don't I just go ahead? I might stop once or twice just to make a comment. Okay, do you want me to say anything else, Nick?
Oh, please do. That would be wonderful. Please go ahead.
Okay. So this is a little before 9 o'clock in the evening, and Jesus is appearing again to a group of believers as they were about to leave. The crowd was dispersing, and he says, "Peace be upon you. You rejoice to know that the Son of Man has risen from the dead, because you thereby know that you and your brethren shall also survive mortal death. But such survival is dependent on your having previously born of the spirit of truth-seeking and God-finding. The bread of life and the water thereof are given only to those who hunger for truth and thirst for righteousness. For God, the fact that the dead rise is not the gospel of the kingdom. These great truths and these universal facts are all related to this gospel, and that they are part of the result of believing the good news and are embraced in the subsequent experience of those who by faith become indeed in truth the everlasting sons of the eternal God. My Father sent me into the world to proclaim this salvation of sonship to all, I want to say people, and so send I you abroad to preach this salvation of sonship. Salvation is the free gift of God. But those who are born of the Spirit will immediately begin to show forth the fruits of the Spirit and loving service to their fellow creatures." And here's the list. There are always an adjective, the verb. "And the fruits of the Divine Spirit, which are yielded in the lives of Spirit-born and God-knowing mortals, are: 1. Loving service. 2. Unselfish devotion. 3. Courageous loyalty. 4. Sincere fairness. 5. Enlightened honesty. 6. Undying hope. 7. Confiding trust. 8. Merciful ministry. 9. Unfailing goodness. 10. Forgiving tolerance. And loving, enduring peace." I'm going to stop there. Why this list is so beautiful to me is that people easily banter around words like loyalty or trust or peace or being fair, but this group of words qualifies and asks for rational thinking of the mind as well as the heart, like courageous loyalty. It's not enough to say that I'm loyal to you. Sometimes we have to be courageous in our loyalty, which includes tough love, and on and on. So this came out of Jesus speaking to people after his crucifixion and resurrection. And I actually took these loving words and put them on index cards and have them posted on my closet door with magic marker and a few symbols and a little bit of ribbon. And I wake up every morning and I look at them and say, "Oh, do I need trust today? Do I need forgiveness today? Do I need hope today?" Dying hope, meaning that the hope never ends. That's what the world needs so much today. So that's the passage I chose to share with you.
Well, Linda, I have to say that was an excellent choice, absolutely excellent choice. Beautifully done. Now, our listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or give a comment for either Linda or myself, we would welcome that. I'm going to give you my email address right now, if you have a pen and a piece of paper, and you can address it to that email. If it's for Linda, I will forward it to her. So here we go. I'm going to give you my email address, which is N-I-C-K-N-Y-N-Y 1. And the 1 is the numeral 1, not O-N-E, but the numeral 1 at gmail.com. Again, N-I-C-K-N-Y-N-Y 1 at gmail.com. We welcome any of your comments or questions that you may have. Hercules, how much more time do we have before we have to run?
Around three minutes or so.
3 minutes. All right. Well, Linda, I have to thank you so much. A heartfelt thanks to you for sharing your insights about the Arantia book and about your life and your goals, which are truly wonderful. Again, I would like to have you back. I'll give you some dates for the beginning of next year, which is, it's just coming right up. It's amazing how close the new year is coming, and that you could let me know what's good for you. And I would very much like to have a whole program on hospice, the general subject of the hospice situation, your personal experiences, stories, and insights you would have on that subject. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure, we can talk offline and see where we want to go with that. We need to have a little structure, I think, to
sure. We can absolutely do that. Right.
Okay.
So we'll do that for sure. And just much success to you. So I'm going to go ahead now and give our closing, which is, here we go. This is Nick Curto for Nick Curto Presents The Arantia Book, wishing you all an enlightened journey. Till next time, please explore the deep wisdom and limitless love contained in the Arantia book. Stay safe and be very, very kind to one another. Goodbye for now. Much love to everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick, and thank you, Linda, for an excellent show. And thanks to everybody who tuned in. Whether you called and you're in our queue or you clicked on a link and found yourself here, or whether you'll be checking us out later on demand. Until next time, from us to you, joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And now we'll close with a song by Virginia Ackley, If You Can Dream.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you love and trust are deep and fair. There is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream.